early in the morning, rise into the street. Throw me on that necktie, strap wingtips on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason she was wrong. Got to find a reason, the client's money's all gone. Always on my iPad.
All right, welcome to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Simon, one of the Simon brothers. And today we're talking about all things MedMail. I don't think we've done a MedMail podcast before, so this will be a long time coming. So we'll do some introductions. So to my immediate right is...
Jennifer Johnson.
Jennifer, why don't you introduce yourself?
Right. So my name is Jennifer Johnson. I have a very creatively named law firm, the Law Office of Jennifer R. Johnson. I'm a former ICU nurse, now a lawyer, was a defense lawyer, and I often say what distinguishes me from other personal injury and MedMail lawyers is I can also give an enema and start an IV.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just saying.
And you recently were a Top Gun recipient winner, were you not, for OCTLA?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I never really sought to get an award. It wasn't a bucket list thing, and I almost wanted to turn it down because I thought, this isn't why I do this, but... It was a great honor, and it made a huge difference in my career. I'm really grateful.
That's great. So to my left, introduce yourself, Ben.
Ben Ikuta.
I can lean back, right?
Yeah, I think the mic can pick you up.
Can you hear me? Ben Ikuta. I went to law school at Hastings, graduated in 2008, did MedMail defense for a lot of years, got sick of working on the dark side and for insurance companies. I beat Dan Hodes in the case, so he called me, offered me a job. Joined his firm about 5 years ago, and I focus my practice in MedMail.
And all three of you, and Michelle will introduce you in a second as well, but all three of you used to do defense work, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Michelle, why don't you introduce yourself, please?
Michelle Hemsap, and I think that Ben forgot to mention that in May of this year, he was made a named partner, so I work at Hodes, Milman, Ikuta. Mm. We met on the defense side, and then he stole me away about 6 months ago, and so I've been at his firm since then.
All right, so... We don't do MedMail at my firm,
smart.
Simon Law Group.
Really smart.
And the reason we don't is because it's hard. So you've been doing this for quite some time. Jennifer, tell us why don't these top-notch attorneys that you see, well, I don't want, you know, I'm not patting ourselves on the back, I mean, not everybody should be doing MedMail. Why doesn't everybody do MedMail? Why is it so difficult?
I mean... MedMail is really a calling for me. I mean, it's more than a way to make a living. It's more than a way to put food or money on the table. I mean, it's what I'm meant to do. But that said, every single case is a street fight. Every single case, you have to just be prepared that you will force them to settle the case. It's because of a number of reasons, but limitations on attorney fees, the MedMail cap. I mean, I bet I said this 100 times if I've said it once in the last year. To do MedMail, plaintiff work in California, you have to not be greedy, you have to be really passionate about justice, and you have to be a little crazy. Now, those two qualify. I don't know if I qualify in that third prong, but they definitely do.
Yeah, so I mean, this, and we actually had Nick Rowley, maybe a year ago, talking about MICRA and the cap and trying to get it lifted. And so, Ben, can you talk a little bit more about the MICRA cap, the general damages cap, the attorney cap? I mean, why these almost barriers to entry for attorneys, plaintiff's attorneys who wanted to do MedMail? Tell us about how it works in the MedMail world.
Yeah, sure. So the cap is a cap on non-economic damages of $250,000. It was passed in 1975, has not risen a cent for inflation since then. It makes it so hard. It really does. And what a lot of lawyers don't understand is that it's not like an insurance limit, right? If you have a $250,000 pulse limit in an auto case, there's still there's still incentive for the insurance company to settle. There's, you can still put pressure on them. There's a potential bad faith case there, right, if the damages exceed $250. In Med-Mal, it's a hard cap. It's an absolute hard cap. And so the insurance companies, they know the worst case scenario. They know that. And so that they will never pay $250 on a $250 case because there's no reason for them to do so.
Yeah, if that's the most I have to pay, why do I need to pay it right now?
Exactly. And they'll fight every case just to dissuade us and other lawyers from taking cases in the future. So every case, like Jennifer said, is just a dogfight. It's tough. And, you know, I've heard a lot of complaints and, you know, from my general PI guys about lowball offers. We don't get offers. we don't get offers in med-mal cases. Right. So, you know, when you combine that with the fact that, you know, people like doctors, you know, juries don't feel qualified to judge doctors or their discretion, and it just makes it very difficult to win cases.
I mean, you say you don't get offers. I mean, how, in our world, I mean, a personal injury firm, and we're a trial firm, we try, I don't know, non-COVID world, maybe 24 cases a year. We still settle 98-99% of our cases. Is that how it works in Med-Mal when you're the plaintiff's attorney? I mean, how often are you settling cases? Do you have to go to the mat all the time, Michelle?
So I would say that while you don't settle cases, you don't settle cases pre-lit. There's definitely cases that settle after you filed a lawsuit, after you've beaten an MSJ, after you've taken expert depositions. It's just they force you to put in all of this money first, because those costs, unlike in a PI case, those are coming out of the net, and then your attorney's fees are off that gross. So not only are you getting hit by this $250 cap and by the fact that attorney's fees are structured based on the amount, you're getting hit because those costs are coming out, and then your attorney's fees are after those costs.
Can I just jump in? Because to the point, and Michelle's making such a great point, because we actually were just talking amongst ourselves, like, how many times have you settled a case pre-lit? And I have been a lawyer for 29 years, and yesterday I got paid on the first case that I've ever settled in the pre-litigation phase in a Med-Mal. And 100% of my practice has been Med-Mal almost my entire career.
Wow.
And this adjuster, it was a hospital in the Inland Valley, wrongful death of an 82-year-old, Brandon. I sent a 364 letter, which the theoretical reason is to incentivize early settlements. In reality, does that ever happen, guys?
No.
Okay. So the adjuster from Pennsylvania, who works for the company that owns this hospital, sends me an email and says, I'd like to settle this pre-lit. And I literally ran down the hall and I was like, they want to settle pre-lit. And they ended up, and when I talked to her in negotiating, she said, you know what? We're not even worried about this case. I looked at this case. I realized it's California. You know, you guys have MICRA. I'm not worried about y'all. And I'm like, really? We have MICRA? I'm so glad you're telling me. I didn't know about that. But I mean, and they ended up paying $225, but in my entire career, that it just doesn't happen.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so I think you mentioned it. One of the other things is, people like doctors.
Yep.
Nobody wants to sue doctors, especially in today's climate where the healthcare workers, I mean, my wife's a nurse, JJ was a nurse. I mean, they're there to help people. And so you have an uphill battle, and they know that. The insurance company knows that.
Exactly, yeah. I think the statistics show that 85% of all cases that go to trial are defense verdicts.
Mm-hmm.
In Med-Mal, and they know that. And that really leads to, you know, just no offers. And you asked the question before about, well, how do your cases settle? We have to be extremely selective. I mean, that's really the answer. We have to, we only take like 2% of cases that come in the door, even though there are great cases we turn down that will never get filed, where there's egregious malpractice, where someone dies. Due to preventable malpractice, those cases just go away because of the cap.
Yeah, and something that I kind of lose sight of a lot, I say the word cases a lot, you know, and sometimes you forget, especially when you're sitting behind I'm not talking to you. You're sitting behind a computer screen looking at a case file, you know, looking at these medical records. I don't want to take this case. These are people, you know, these are people who have been injured because of no fault of their own. They should have recourses, and theoretically, there's a system in place where you can get recovery, but you really, it's set up to where you can't, you shouldn't be able to. It's set up for you to fail.
Exactly. I mean, our average trial costs probably $100,000. And so if we take a case, a 250 case, max case, you know, our attorney fees, and that would be 60 grand. The client would get maybe 100 max.
And you're not getting costs on top of the 250.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
And it's just such an unfair system where we can't economically take cases like that. We just can't. We go bankrupt. So a lot of righteous cases never get filed.
And the one thing, too, if I can just jump in there, is like if somebody comes to you, Brandon, with a case where there was an accident, somebody's injured, and there may or may not be a police report, there's probably going to be a case there. I mean, I would imagine. Yeah. I don't do PI. I'm scared of it. So I don't know. But in our cases, like, sometimes I just feel so badly because people send me, like, 10 cases and nothing's a case. Nothing's a case. I mean, like, we have to vet our cases so carefully. And so one thing I would say to the general PI lawyer that doesn't do this area of law or maybe just dabbles in it, you know, you have to understand that we just have to be so selective. And just because there's a big injury or just because there's great, what looks like great negligence or a bad result, oftentimes that does not equate to a case. And so, you know, I mean, I agree with Ben's stats and maybe 2% of the cases we look at.
Can I jump in one more point? Another reason why cases don't settle in Med-Mal is because unlike in an auto case, doctor consent is required to settle a case. And that's because settlements over $30,000 have to be reported to the medical board and it can impact their license. So a lot of doctors, particularly the bad ones, the ones that already have a black mark on their record, they would prefer to roll the dice and go to trial.
Especially with, 85% chance. Of,
absolutely.
And another thing that, Michelle, I'll ask you is, in our world, we're thankful. Thankfully, it's in a place in the personal injury world where collateral source rule shouldn't come into play. I mean, we've taken cases up on appeal, and we've set a pretty good precedent where you can choose to treat on a lien. You don't have to treat through your health insurance, and that stuff comes out. You know, a spine surgery is very expensive, and we're allowed to go to trial and say, hey, we need 2 or 3 spine surgeries in the future, not on insurance. You're not allowed to talk about insurance. $1 million. That's not what happens in your world, right?
Right. So another terrible part of MICRA, which is actually a collection of these different laws, not just the 250 cap, is that insurance comes in. So if, let's say, Anthem Blue Cross paid $100,000 for the past medicals, Anthem Blue Cross is not entitled to get that $100,000 back. So you can most certainly put in evidence of it, but the jury gets to know that Anthem paid that money. Now, if it's someone like Medicare or Medi-Cal, then they have a lien, they're entitled to reimbursement. But for future medicals, so that's like a way to bring up the value of a Med-Mal case. What are the future medicals? Well, let's say you've got a baby that's been injured and requires care for the rest of that child's life. Well, insurance now comes into play there. And there, the defense, when I was on the defense side, started hiring these insurance specialists to talk about, you know, well, the ACA requires everybody to have insurance. And so what would it cost for this medical plan and for this medical care through that medical plan? And so you've now taken a life care plan that might be $10 million, and that is now significantly less because we're looking at what's the cost of premiums and the max out of pocket.
And when you're in trial and you're arguing, and this is why it shouldn't come in, because it turns a trial into a trial into a trial. And that's why it doesn't come in most of the time in personal injury world. But are you allowed in your world to argue the sort of level of care? I mean, this is Medicare. These are the Medicare costs. If you're giving me future medical care, why shouldn't I be allowed to have the best medical care? Why should I only be allowed to take, why are you giving me future medical care that only provides state funded doctors? Why can't you give me the best care? Why can't you give me $100,000 for the surgery and I can go through cash pay? Are you allowed to make those arguments at trial?
I mean, you can most certainly make them, but I think you have to, what is the jury going to think when they're saying you can get this top of the line PPO plan that allows you to go to basically most doctors. Right. You can go to almost any hospital, and they're going to think, well, what's the more reasonable thing? You might as well just take this platinum PPO plan, and you're going to get all the care that you want through these specialists who are taking these this plan.
So we've spent, I don't know, 15 minutes talking about how terrible MedMouth is and why nobody should do it. So, I mean, I would like to encourage some people coming out of law school or, you know, who work on the defense side to do medical malpractice. So why do you do it, Jennifer?
I'm so glad you asked. I've thought about that a lot. You know, as I referenced earlier, for me, it's a calling. I mean, I come up from a family of nurses, and my dad was a minister. I come from a family of people who dedicated their life to the service of others. And so that's kind of my mindset from my nursing background. And, you know, I just find that the most meaningful life is in service to others. That said, you have to pay your bills. Okay. And, you know, you can't spend $60,000 on a case that's worth $100,000. But for me, I just find, you know, when I started my firm in 2012, people told me, do not say you do MedMal. Don't say that. And so I would take some PI cases, and I would get so much anxiety because I felt like I didn't really know what I was doing. I wasn't passionate about them. Yeah, they settled quickly, but I didn't feel like somebody needs to do something about what happened here. And I know there are those PI cases, but you know, I'm not the Simon Law group. And so I wasn't getting those big cases, but the smaller cases. And so finally I just realized, you know what? Everything I've done from, you know, being a nurse to being a defense lawyer to working at the firm that the predecessor firm was Dan Hose and Jeff Millman's prior firm, where Ben's their partner and Michelle works, you know, I just felt like this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah, it is a street fight. Every case is a street fight. Every case, I have to just beat them into submission pretty much. And but I can help clients who are often going through the absolute worst thing they've been through in their life. And I'm sure Michelle and Ben would agree that most of the clients we represent, because of the cases we have to take, the kinds of cases we have to take, are going through the worst thing that they're going through in their life. We can flip that on its head, do something good, not only for those people, but we can bring a purpose out of this pain that these people are going through. And we can also send a message that what happened here is not okay. And people, you know, my clients really get behind that. We can find a purpose to the reason we lost this baby. I can find a purpose to the reason I'm paralyzed as a result of malpractice. And so for me, it's just so incredibly rewarding. And it's my passion, and I'm going to keep doing it.
Well, I didn't expect to almost cry.
You don't know me.
Yeah. Ben, what is your... Everyone that I've ever spoken to that does MedMal, you need to have, not that you shouldn't have a passion in anything you do, but there seems to be a little bit more of a personal connection and almost need to do this sort of work.
Yeah. I honestly, I love all of my clients. I really do. They're just wonderful. Because we're so selective in our cases, we end up with just the best clients. Sorry, I'm thinking how to answer that question. I apologize.
I mean, people that you that you want to fight for. I mean, it's just
absolutely, yeah. And on top of that, you know, the medicine's so interesting too. It's really fascinating, and it's easy to work hard for clients like ours. It really is. So,
Michelle.
Well, I would say that I did defense work, medical malpractice defense work before I switched over, and you know, I love the medicine. It's fascinating. It's interesting. But I would see sometimes cases that came in and I was like, this is wrong. But we would find one doctor to review it and get a negative review, and then another doctor to review it and get a negative review, and then and third doctor to review it and then finally get a positive review. And you're like, this doctor is a terrible doctor that should no longer be in practice.
Yes.
And I don't want to be the person that's protecting those doctors. I want to be the person that is making those doctors answer for what they've done. And So that's why I decided that this was what I wanted to do. It's not easy, and it's definitely not as lucrative as the PI cases, but, you know, I'm hoping that I'm making a difference.
So, I mean, we've been fighting the microcap since it came into play, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that fight's going anywhere. I mean, I don't know if you have any insight to it, but it is there, and you have been dealing with it, especially the 250 generals cap. Have you found creative ways to, because the jury's not even allowed to hear that there's a cap, right? You tell them, hey, right. I want $10 million. This baby is paralyzed. A jury's give you probably whatever you want, but they don't know that there's a cap there. Is there a creative way to use that to your advantage, or to get above that? And Jennifer, you've mentioned to me last week, punitive damages, something creative ways. So how have you been able to maximize value on MedMal cases despite that gap?
Well, we talked about this, and this does not, it definitely doesn't happen in every single case. So there's no question about that. But I think it happens more than I used to at least recognize, the fact that you can actually, under a part of the MICRA scheme, under CCP 425.13, you can actually bring a motion to seek punitive damages if you have reckless, outrageous behavior, if you have fraud, if you have grounds for intentional torts or punitive damages. And I think that in the category of maybe shameless self-promotion, I think I've won 6 of those motions in the past 2 years, and I have one pending right now. And defense lawyers, they go bonkers. They absolutely hate it. Mediators will tell you, this is not going to help you settle your case. It's like, yes, it does. It puts incredible pressure on the defense. And basically, it's a motion that is very time sensitive. So you have to bring it within 9 months of your first trial date. Now, in COVID, that's easier. But I mean, in these cases that I won Top Gun for, I won punitive damages in all 3 cases, which were consolidated against all 3 defendants. And my hair was literally on fire to get that filed in a timely manner, because I knew it was a punitive damage case. And the defense just had a complete and utter unified defense of stonewalling. And I had to do 20 motions to compel to get the basic discovery to even allow me to bring my motion in the first place. And what I would say is, as long as your expert will go along with you and sign a declaration that meets the requirements of Civil Code 3294, either 1C1 or if you have the fraud portion of it, then it's almost impossible for the defense to defend that, because it's almost like a reverse MSJ. The defense, the judge is not supposed to weigh the evidence. Mm. So and Ben's actually had success, and good success in this too, where once you get your motion on file, if your expert is with you, the defense tries to make it a MSJ, like, oh, well, there's a tribal issue. No, it's not that kind of motion. It's like the judge cannot weigh the evidence. If you've made your prima facie case, mm-hmm. and you've met that burden, you should win that motion. And again, it puts incredible pressure, and it also raises that microcap.
And Ben, that's something that you have been doing it, or have done at your firm as well?
Yes,
I mean, give us an example of maybe what that would entail to be able to allege something like that. You mean messing with medical records, or a habit of doing the same type of mistake? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so Section 425.13 requires a substantial probability of prevailing on the punitive damage claim. It's the same exact standard, at least language, of the motion to get pretrial financial discovery. But the standard is, frankly, a lot easier. If you can just show enough evidence to meet that standard, you can add the punies into the complaint. Examples of cases, you know, I had a case where it was granted where a doctor with an interesting medical board history of having sex with patients and leaving people to die on the operating table, with my client, did a liposuction, and he perforated the bowel in 4 separate places. The patient came to him with clear signs of a bowel perforation, like his stomach was inflated, like he was pregnant. He had a temperature, he was sickly, he looked like he was about to die. Doctor said, oh, you're fine, go home.
He goes to the hospital where the doctor on staff says, oh my gosh, this guy's in really bad shape. Let me call the surgeon up and see how he's doing. Calls the surgeon up and says, hey, you know, this guy's in really bad shape. Can we transfer him to a hospital where you're at, where you have privileges at? Well, of course, this doctor had no privileges at any hospital because he was such a terrible doctor with a bad history. He said, no, don't transfer him to my hospital. He's fine. This is an expected result of surgery. Leave him be, blah, blah, blah. And they left him for 2 days while he had just literal feces just going through his entire system, became extremely septic. They opened him up, discovered this absolute mess, had to basically remove all of his stomach muscle, had to cut out feet of his intestines, and he ended up hospitalized for 3 months. That would be an example of a case, yeah. Right?
So I hope so.
The short answer is, frankly, you need to have egregious facts.
Yeah,
I mean,
what's crazy to me is if you can't get punitive damages, everything that guy went through is capped. The pain and suffering and the inconvenience and that he had to go through is capped at $250,000.
Exactly right. Let me tell you the end of that story, which is really tragic. He had insurance. I settled that case for $250,000. So the point of the motion is to get the $250,000.
Yeah.
The point of the motion is not to get more than $250,000, because otherwise I wouldn't even get that, right? So, obviously the doctor, he wouldn't consent to settlement. But now with the motion and now with the allegations of punitive damages in the complaint, now his personal assets are at risk. He had to consent, and that's how you get the $250,000. So, yeah, it really is tragic.
Doom Yikes. And gloom,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know plenty of colleagues that do MedMal, but hearing the stories that people have to go through because of not only negligence, but just egregious. In that case, if that case was in personal injury world, that case would be worth $20 million, probably. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how we can continue to have that cap and have MICRA and everyone's fine with it. You know, our blue state, our Democratic governor, and everyone's just, it's fine,
Brandon, we were talking about this, and I think for the jury to really go along with us, especially it makes a difference where we are, whether Orange County mm-hmm. or LA or what have you. But I think jurors have to believe what happened to them could happen to me. I think they have to, and sometimes to believe that what happened to Ben's client, I can't, psychologically it's too painful to go there, or if somebody's baby dies, you just don't want to believe that this could actually happen to you. And one of the situations where I won punitive damages as orthopedic surgeon was literally infecting his spine patients with his own infection that was well known. So you don't want to believe that these egregious facts could actually happen to you. So I think that's part of why MICRA stays as it is, or it has to this point.
Yeah, it's literally like if you hear stories, and it's just, even though I'm in sort of this profession, or at least the adjacent profession, it's still unbelievable the stuff that happens and nothing really changes. So what about intentional acts, intentional torts? Is your experience with that, Michelle, in MedMal world?
Yeah, so I mean, you can allege obviously intentional torts like battery, or if there's like a sexual assault component to it, or fraud, but those, I think you obviously need to understand, are also not covered under these policies. So yes, it can in theory increase the value of your case, but it's that those aren't covered claims.
So give me an example. I mean, I know a classic one from law school is they did a surgery that wasn't consented to. Isn't that a classic form of like battery?
Yeah. So maybe,
but that's not covered under.
No. But then you're still looking at a $250,000 cap, right? Because what's covered is the negligence aspect of it,
gotcha.
And it's covered under the MICRA claim. So I mean, the real ways to increase the value of your case is really looking at what the economics are on your case.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, when you're looking at cases coming in the door, there has to be a pretty high price tag on medical costs moving forward. And even if there is, I mean, you're still dealing with insurance and Medicare rates and all that. So it has to be a pretty substantial injury to justify taking the case, right?
Right. So, I mean, we're looking at, unfortunately, how much money did this person earn for a living? So are they a breadwinner? That's an important factor. Is there a big lost wages claim? So if you're really young or really old, then, you know, most of the time you're looking at that $250.
And this is almost discriminates against people who are low income. I mean, it doesn't almost. It does discriminate.
It does.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Right.
So their value of their life is much lower than if you're, you know, a Hispanic day laborer who has 10 kids and you're the breadwinner for that family. Your life isn't the same as if you're a doctor earning six figures and you've lost your income. That case is worth substantially more when it shouldn't be.
That's true, yes. It's discriminatory, most certainly against minorities. It's terrible. MICRA affects not just, you know, the young and the old, but it affects, you know, blacks and Hispanics, because when you're looking at, well, what is this person gonna earn for the rest of their life? Well, I mean, unfortunately, when we look at cases, we're looking at, oh, it's a successful white male who's, you know, earning six figures. I mean, that's, you see that case, you're like, okay, that's probably a case I want to take because the economics on it makes sense. The other way the economics make sense are if there's future medical care. Yes, I mean, there's the issue with the health insurance, but still those are cases that we'll look at more closely, because those future meds, it's an argument at least to say this life care plan is worth, you know, $10 million.
So, I mean, you said MICRA was enacted in 74, is that what?
75.
if it hasn't been overturned yet, I mean, what's it going to take? What's the current status? I mean, how close are we to getting some relief?
What it's going to take is, I think, everybody talking to their friends, their family, their legislatures. I mean, talk to everybody you know about it and tell them why this has to be changed. It's not just that lawyers are greedy and they want more money, which is what the insurance companies will tell you. It's that these people are underrepresented because of, unfortunately, this law, and they deserve more than what they can get. And a baby's life shouldn't be worth less just because they're a baby. And Nick Rally has spearheaded this initiative that's coming up for vote in November of next year. I believe the act is called the Fairness for Injured Patients Act or Injured Victims Act. And that should, I hope, pass this time. There's a documentary that just came out called Never Events. And so there, I mean, talk to your friends. Talk to your family members, talk to other healthcare providers, and explain to them that this isn't, you know, to raise the healthcare costs. This is to provide justice for loved ones, for people.
As if healthcare costs could get any higher.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But I mean, in Prop 46 in 2016, yeah, we tried the same thing. It's my understanding that the bill was not the best bill. It had some undesirable portions. But I think I'm pretty good information. Michelle and Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that between Kaiser, Doctors Company, NorCal, each of the insurance companies, or a number of them, put up a minimum of $10 million. Am I remembering correctly?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah.
Cap, yeah, all of them, $10 million each.
Yeah, right, to defeat this.
Just ran constant ads.
To defeat Prop 46. Am I remembering the right number? Correct. 46. Yeah. So, yeah.
So, I mean, we're getting close to the end here, but I mean, if you were to, somebody's listening who's coming out of law school or is now out of law school, who's practicing and maybe not doing this line of work, but wants to start doing this line of work, there's been a lot of, like Michelle said, doom and gloom, sort of barriers to entry. What would you tell those people who, because you, I mean, you're in it because you want to do it. I mean, you're not here because you've been forced and this is a paycheck, right? You're doing this line of work because this is what you like to do and this is what you're passionate about. So what would you tell these people? Get into MedMal, you know, do it.
I would tell them, come and talk to me. I would be happy to mentor you. Talk to another attorney that does MedMal, because the last thing that you want to do is be the person that is taking this case and doesn't know what you're doing. When I was doing defense work and writing reports, you know, the first section is on the parties, and I would put in there who's plaintiff's counsel and a blurb on them, and especially whether or not they did medical malpractice. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is it's so important to find someone that will mentor you. And I am happy to do it. I love talking to law students. I'm the president right now of Women Lawyers of Long Beach. And so if you are interested in it, I would be happy to just sit down and talk with you about it.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Michelle said. The vast majority of my referrals come from lawyers who have taken that one MedMal case and just taking an absolute bath on it and got crushed. Yes. And lost a bunch of money. And I promise you, I'm not begging for work here. Just give me a call and I can tell you if it's a good or bad case, if it's a case worth pursuing. Michelle's absolutely right. You know, call one of us.
Totally agree. And I would just say that, you know, I saw firsthand this summer at the what we call the Tort Fork, because we all office at the same building, 9210 Irvine Center Drive. But we hosted interns this summer. We had four separate interns, and Michelle and Ben were just amazing mentors to our law students. I participated, and it was just really amazing. And the comments from those attorney or from those budding attorneys who are law students was like, man, our perception is so different of MedMal lawyers, because, you know, I mean, I think they had that common perception about MedMal or even PI that we're chasing ambulances. But when you see that we're putting our money where our mouth is, and we're literally giving access to justice for people that would not otherwise, these marginalized people that would not have the ability to get into court if we didn't actually put out $100,000 per case or whatever it takes to get them justice. And so, you know, I would just echo what Michelle said, you know, contact one of us. And by the way, I mean, we often co-counsel with each other, because I don't know if it's because I never even contemplated this or even the question till this moment, but, you know, there's not this cutthroat competitive nature among our firms. We co-counsel. If somebody comes to Ben's firm and my firm and we realize we're both talking to the same person, we'll give them two for one. You know, it's like that. I mean, we support each other in, you know, so to a young lawyer, it's like, try it out, see if you like it before you actually do take that step and start your firm and actually put yourself on the line and your assets for, you know, the chance to bring
justice. I mean, another thing is, I assume that the machine you're going up against, when you're going against defense firms who represent doctors, I mean, I assume you're probably getting outgunned, you know, 10-1 in terms of manpower. It's probably not an easy, like you said, a street fight. Am I underestimating it?
Not at all. I mean, in these cases that I settled last year, at the end, I ended up bringing in co-counsel. But I would show up at motions, and it would be me on the plaintiff's side. And at one motion, they literally had six lawyers from three major firms against me. And actually, I've shared this especially with Michelle, because as women, we're often underestimated. And, you know, I love it when they say, oh, you know, you're not in, or you're inexperienced, or, you know, it's just you. It's just you against them. I love that, because that can play to our advantage.
I think we're almost done, but I am curious. I assume you have friends on the defense side that do defense work, MedMal work. Ben was a little more hesitant. I'm curious how they feel about the system and how it's set up. I know there's probably some bias, because they are representing doctors and they want to get these doctors clear their name, blah blah blah, but there has to be some recognition on their side, maybe behind closed doors, that the system's not fair.
the firm that Michelle and I were at previously, back in the mid-90s, what happened was this. Let me start all over. What happened was, there's a big MedMal firm, and one of the major partners there spoke out in favor of repealing MICRA, of overturning MICRA. And the day that happened, Kaiser and these insurance companies had trucks go to that office and say, put all of your files in this truck and drive them over to this other law firm. And that's how the firm that Michelle and I used to work at, the defense firm, really, you know, established itself, because, you know, the trucks were all driven there.
They literally.
Know, yeah, literally. Trucks literally driven there that. With these. Yeah, the Carroll Kelly firm was started that way. And they know, and they will tell us behind closed doors that absolutely Micra is just awful and that it needs to be overturned. And they want to be overturned too, because their rates haven't gone up either.
Yeah, right. Right.
So yeah. They want it overturned as well. But of course, they can't say that publicly.
Right, right. But I also think that they, if they get some negative reviews, they also realize that they have to settle a case. And when I was on the defense side and I had a terrible, terrible case where a baby died during a delivery, I told plaintiff's counsel, who's actually Krista Ramey, who's a member of JHQ, that I felt so bad for her and I was very sorry, you know, and we ended up resolving that case because it was just so egregious. So I know that there are some defense attorneys that are out there that have a heart, and, you know, they feel like what has happened is wrong, and sometimes they're like, this doctor has hurt too many people, I'm not going to represent them anymore. I mean, it's rare. Yeah. It happens.
Yeah. Wow.
Those are the most heartbreaking. I mean, the child death cases, we just get them all the time. Every single day, we get a child death case or a referral or an intake.
And that case is worth...
is worth maximum
$250,000, and you have to spend and time and money to get that. So it's really not even worth $250,000.
And to be clear, the 250 cap applies no matter how many wrongdoers there are. And so what happens is, if you sue the hospital and don't sue the doctor, the hospital will blame the OBGYN, and right. vice versa. If you sue only the doctor, they'll blame the hospital. So you have to sue both. And now you're going up against two different law firms, mm-hmm. and we'll just paper you to death.
You pretend, and you need two different experts, right? Because you need to have an obstetrician and then a nurse, because it's liability based on both of their conduct. So, I mean, they just get very expensive.
So you're spending probably 50 to 60 grand on that case, conservatively.
Yeah, minimum.
Your attorney's fees are, I know, they're capped, but what are they? I mean, what's going to the family at the end of all of that fight? Probably 2.5 years worth of suing that hospital over the death of their unborn child that is clearly wrong. What does that family get? 30 grand?
The hypothetical answer is maybe 100 grand if you win the case. The real answer is typically zero, because we can't take that case. Mm-hmm. We can't take that case financially. Mm-hmm. So no one will take it. Right. I mean, it's just... I have made it a personal mission to take a lot more the child death cases, just because they're so heartbreaking. And when you see the same hospitals involved over and over and over again, with women who would be literally better off delivering a baby in the bathtub mm-hmm. at home versus going to the hospital and being pumped full of medication and not being monitored, leading to extreme fetal distress, it's just absolutely heartbreaking. So...
Well, on that note,
geez. Sorry, I'm a daughter. I'm sorry.
It's definitely, I have friends that do MedMal. I don't have these types of conversations with them, you know? So it's definitely a bit eye-opening to see you guys are actually real attorneys.
So you know, I think that the best way companies. To end this, though, would be that the positive thing out of today is to realize all of these negative things and share that.
Yeah.
Since, you know... you didn't know this, but that means so many other people who aren't lawyers don't know this. And if it could be shared amongst, you know, your friends, your colleagues, your neighbors, and tell them why this law is so terrible, maybe it will be changed.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, I mean, I know, you know, I often stay in touch with clients for years after... I mean, years after their case is resolved. And I know, Ben, I know you do the same thing. I know, and I'm sure you do too, Michelle. I mean, it's almost like you create a bond when you go through something like this and when you fight hard for justice for these people. And I mean, I don't know, this is why I went to law school. I mean, I'm up for a fight, and it's not a fair fight. But, you know, there is just something really rewarding about just being willing to be that street fighter and take on this very difficult area of law and to just really fight for justice for these victims. in, and if MICRA doesn't change, I'm still going to keep doing this law, this kind of law. I love it. And it's extremely rewarding. And when you see the changed lives, the people that we can represent, that, you know, that we can literally make a difference, it does become worth it, at least in my book.
All right. When is when's the ballot measure? Is it is it a ballot measure?
It's next in year? November with okay. the election, November 2022.
Okay. So anyone that's watching this between now and then, I mean, you're gonna see a lot of ads, I'm sure.
Voting by the other side,
on, yeah. voting no on, and trial attorneys are greedy and everything. And so hopefully, any time that you see a family member or a friend who doesn't know how to vote on that, I mean. Send this YouTube video to them. I mean, show them that this is what goes on behind the scenes, and hopefully that can make a difference. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
This was really insightful. It's definitely eye-opening for people who don't do this type of thing. So thank you so much. And Hudson will kill me if I don't say there's no sleep till justice. So thank you so much.
Thanks, friend. Thank you. Appreciate it.